The Triathlon Show for a 90. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode we have another Q&A. Last week we had a Q&A specifically about off-season training, and today we go into some more general questions related to training, coaching and performance. And I want to remind you that if you want to make sure that you get the opportunity to submit your questions for future Q&A episodes, then please follow Scientific Triathlon HQ on Instagram and sign up for our newsletter on scientifictriathlon.com/newsletter. I also try to, of course, put out the requests for questions in the actual podcast episodes themselves, but the problem is that sometimes I record episodes quite far in advance, and I might not have the full schedule for, let's say, 4 or 5 weeks later. So it's not always possible to get in those requests here in the episodes, but when I can, I of course try to do that as well. But yeah, if you can, follow us on Instagram and the newsletter, and that's your best avenue for seeing those requests for questions. Also, another quick piece of housekeeping is that we have had one room open up for our Mallorca training camp in April 2024. This accommodation is a suite, so it has a minimum occupancy of 2 people, which means that it might be ideal for a couple or 2 friends that want to join the camp together, or actually 3 friends or 3 people. But even if you're interested in joining the camp solo, you can just email me, and if there are more people in the same situation as you, then there might be an opportunity there to put you together with somebody else who is looking for to join the camp, but also is a solo camper, so to say. So email me, whatever your situation, if you're interested in joining the camp, at michael@scientificdraftlon.com for more information. And it's first come, first serve, basically. So it's best to be quick, as this is the only room that we have available. Otherwise, the camp is sold out, and we will only have more slots if we have cancellations. But if we do, I will announce that on the podcast, so you get the chance. But it's best to not count on that. Try to get in now if you have any interest still of joining the camp. Now, let's thank our sponsors, Precision Fuel Hydration. They help athletes perform at their best with electrolyte and fueling products, and with free online tools, education, and a patented sweat test. You can use the free fuel and hydration planner on their website to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake. And you can also book a free 20-minute video consultation chat for your plan with the athlete support team. I have used their entire range of products for a long time, and I think they're absolutely brilliant. And you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS23 on precisionfuelhydration.com. And thank you to Form. The Form smart swim goggles give you real-time feedback in your swim training right on the goggle lens, including splits, pace, stroke rate, and heart rate. This means that you can execute your swim workouts better and get a better idea of your ability to hold certain paces and stroke rates, and understand when and why you start to slow down. The best thing is that you can see and interpret this data in real time in the session, so it's actually actionable and can help you right then and there. Also, especially if you're swimming solo, it adds some more fun and engagement to swim training, which might make you look forward to your swim sessions in a completely different way. You can get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into this week's Q&A. So the first question that I have here is from Oliver, who asks, my question is related to base training. Would you recommend always running your intensity sessions as hard as possible for the allotted time? For example, for a 1x20-minute tempo effort, should I go as hard as I can for 20 minutes, or should I just maintain in the middle or low end of my tempo range? I'm unsure if there is benefit to working harder or just sitting in the middle of the allotted zone. Thanks in advance. All right, thank you, Oliver, for your question. This is a very common question, I would say, actually, and a very common cause for confusion, especially among athletes that are a bit newer to the sport. It's not a question that I would say is related to, you say, base training. I interpret that as the off-season training. I don't think it's specific to any given time period of the year. I think this question is relevant year-round, and the answer would apply similarly year-round. But generally speaking, if we just first think about the question, should you go as hard as possible in your intense sessions, the answer is that it depends. it depends on things such as the goal of the session, the risk-benefit ratio going all out versus holding back a little bit, and it depends on what's on your schedule in the next few days, and a few other things as well. But the most important one is definitely the goal of the session. So if we look specifically at your example with a 20-minute tempo run, first we need to discuss the terminology here a bit. When you say tempo, cyclists and triathletes will generally use the word tempo or the term tempo to describe zone 3 in a 5-zone system. So for example, for a relatively fit amateur runner, that would be around marathon pace or so. Runners, on the other hand, would often use the term tempo to describe what we might call zone 4 in a 5-zone system. So a pace that a fit runner could hold for, let's say, 10 kilometers to 10 miles in a race. So I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here, but I think that actually sometimes I think that we should just scrap all talk about zones and all talk about tempo and threshold and sweet spot and what have you, and just readjust our dictionary to talk about things like 5K race pace, 10K race pace, half marathon pace, or the equivalent effort. So 5K effort, 10K effort, half marathon effort, and so on. 5-minute power, 20-minute power, 60-minute power, those sorts of things. I think that that would be a whole lot more clear and unambiguous. But back to your question, if we assume that you talk about tempo in more of that traditional running sense, so it's basically your 10K to 10-mile race pace, if that is the purpose of the workout, to work in that speed range, then that's what you should do. You shouldn't go all out, because then it's a different session. If you end up doing a 20-minute all-out effort, that's basically a VO2 max session, which is not a bad thing at all, but it's very different from what you set out to do, which was to work more on the top end of your sustainable pace. So you have done a completely different session with different adaptations, different load, different recovery profile potentially. So basically, when you set out to do a session, you have to know not just what is the duration that you're going to work for, or the interval setup. Is it 5 by 8 minutes, or 1 by 20 minutes, or 3 by 15 minutes? You also have to have a good, clear idea of the specific intensity target, and that doesn't necessarily have to be an exact pace or exact heart rate, but at least, am I working at my 10K race effort, or my marathon race effort, or my 5K race effort? So in some way you have to have an intensity target that you're following, whether that's based on pace or heart rate and RPE. And if you're using pace and heart rate, then also it's important to keep in mind that it shouldn't be just one number necessarily. It should be a range, because every day is slightly different. Some days you feel better, some days you feel not so good, but you can still achieve very similar outcomes of a workout by working in more or less the correct range. So let's say that your normal 10K pace is 4 minutes per kilometer, so a 40-minute 10K, then the range that you're working in for a 10K pace workout could be, let's say, 3:55 to 4:10. So you could be slightly faster, or you could be right at it, or you could be a little bit slower than your normal 10K race pace. And that all of those outcomes, the entire range there, would be perfectly fine for that workout. But anyway, the thing that you have to consider is that you're never trying to maximize your performance or your adaptations for just one workout, because at the end of the day, one workout, no matter how good it is not going to help you improve very much. What's going to help you improve much is to stack workouts week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out, and do many good workouts, but you don't have to do any singular epic workouts necessarily. So that is why for most workouts, I would say you should not go as hard as you can. Of course, the intensity guideline in itself also tells you that if you have a 20-minute effort and your goal is to do it at 10K race pace or 10-mile race pace, then obviously you're not a 20-minute 10K runner or 20-minute 10-mile runner. Nobody is. So you know already from that it's not going to be an all-out effort, but you could potentially design a workout to be all-out by doing, let's say, 2 times 20 minutes or 4 times 15 minutes at your 10K pace with some recovery, and that could be basically you could have to work as hard as you possibly can to hit those targets. But I think that is usually not what you should aim for. The only type of workout where I think it does make sense to go very close to as hard as possible, maybe not quite to that level, but quite close to it, is when you do VO2 max efforts. Because for that type of training, while I wouldn't say that it's fully established and agreed upon, but there does seem to be some good indications that there is some intensity threshold where you need to be quite close to maximum to achieve the desired adaptations. So again, you don't need to necessarily go all out for those types of efforts, but you do need to be working pretty hard, and you shouldn't be too far from that maximum. So when we talk about VO2 max efforts, we're talking about, let's say, 5K race pace efforts and faster. So a typical workout would be 12 times 400 meters would be a perfect example with 1.5 minute recoveries or so 1 minute recoveries. So to summarize, know what the purpose of each session is and set some guardrails for your pace, heart rate, and RPE. Not just guardrails, but just know what you're going for. Are you going for an effort-based, an RPE-based prescription, or are you going for a pace-based prescription? When you're working with pace and heart rate especially, make sure that you have a range, not just a single number, and then on the day, you can adjust within that range based on how you feel. Because on some days, that 20-minute tempo effort, if you do it at 10K race pace, that might actually feel like an all-out effort. But then that's a day maybe when you should say that, okay, I'm going to stick to 10 seconds per kilometer or 15 seconds per mile slower than my 10K race pace to make it a good hard workout, but not an all-out effort. So hopefully that clarifies some of the questions that you had. And yeah, hopefully it helps. Good luck with your training. The next question is from Michael. It's not from myself. This is Michael in Australia, who asks, I think it would be fun to hear you answer your own question. How would you describe your coaching philosophy today, and how has it changed since you founded Scientific Triathlon? So thank you, Michael, for that question. I'd be happy to, or I'll try at least. It's, as you've heard me acknowledge when I asked that question in interviews, I think it's probably one of the hardest questions to answer. I think that my coaching philosophy, or it blends into almost coaching methodology, so it's maybe a bit hard to separate the two, but really it's quite simple. It starts with a really good assessment of where the athlete is right now, where they want to go. So good goal alignment between the coach and the athlete, and understanding where the athlete is right now, and then trying to understand, okay, where do they need to be to training wise to complete a race distance, or to achieve a certain race time or performance goal that they have set for themselves. So this is where we do a bit of a gap analysis. I described this in some detail in last week's episode. The challenging part is not to do that specifically, although that takes some time and requires quite a bit of detailed analysis. But the challenging part is to figure out then how do you actually go from point A to point B. And that might be in multiple different areas. For example, you might need improvements in swimming and biking and running. So you have to have a really good understanding of the athlete's profile and the athlete's constraints. So the athlete's constraints, by that I mean things like work, family, recovery, how much time do they have available to train, and so on. And the athlete's profile, this is where I think a lot of self-coach athletes are really missing out in their analysis, or it ends up being quite one-dimensional and basically boils down to just pure physiology. What is your physiological profile? So, for example, looking at things like your power duration curve and speed duration curve, are you strong over short versus long durations in the three disciplines? Don't get me wrong, that part is essential, and it is maybe the most important part of the athlete profile. And if you're doing that, you're probably already ahead of most people, I would think. But I think it's still missing a huge chunk of what an athlete's profile is. And for me, that includes things like the athlete's psychology and sources of motivation, the biomechanics and anatomy. So to give you an example here, a swimmer's body versus a runner's body, somebody who is very tall versus somebody who is quite short, in terms of running volume, that those are things that will have a pretty big impact, or could potentially have a big impact. Technical skills, training environment, equipment and ability to purchase top-class equipment, personal beliefs about training, this is a huge one as well. And there are others, but those are some of the most important ones, I would say. So when we have an idea of the athlete's profile and the athlete's constraints, then I would first have to assess if the goal that they have is realistic or if it's realistic within a certain time frame, because I'm not somebody that would play along with what I perceive as unrealistic goals. If I think that the goal that the athlete has is not possible to achieve in a given time frame, then I will suggest that the goal should be adjusted to something more realistic. So goal alignment is a critical part of my coaching philosophy, I would say. And this boils down to this, all of this initial analysis that I talked about, understanding the athlete's profile, their constraints, and the goals really, really well. So for any given goal, and to get from point A to point B, there might be 50 paths that could work within a population of triathletes. But based on the individual athlete's profile and constraints, there might be a lot less than that. I don't know, maybe five or less. So what the training looks like is really dependent on these factors, and two athletes with the same point A and same goal point B, but very different profiles and constraints, will obviously have very different training and coaching. And very different coaching doesn't mean just different training. It means what is the focal point of where we can move the needle for the athlete. Because for some athletes, they might already have the fitness to achieve their goals, but we need to work on things like pacing, race, hydration and nutrition, maybe some technical aspects like or aerodynamics on the bike, those sorts of things that are not necessarily just fitness related, which is what we normally think about as the first thing we think about when it comes to training and coaching. But for me, that's an important factor, that where it's more like it's performance coaching, it's not just fitness coaching or physiological coaching. So that's an example of what it can look like on one extreme, where an athlete already has the fitness, then the training is very straightforward, obviously. Obviously, you need to keep training, but your focus is on other areas that can move the needle. But then obviously for a majority of athletes, I would say there is still a large focus on the physical components of training and improving fitness and physiology. And there it becomes a matrix of figuring out the overall workload that the athlete needs to respond well and to achieve their goals. But then what is that workload composed of? What is the level of intensity? What is the volume, the training volume? How is that distributed across the disciplines? And this is where you look at the athlete's profile and constraints, and you need to come to a different solution based on all of those things. And again, not just the physiological profiles, because I could give you some rules of thumb for that, but then it just depends on many other things as well, like the environment the athlete has available to train in and their beliefs about training and so on and so forth. So I think that's a good summary of my philosophy or methodology. So as you can hear, there's nothing about polarized or pyramidal or high volume or low volume. It really depends. I would say it's a bit of an engineering-inspired or engineering-informed approach. It's similar to when I was in engineering, one of my responsibilities was to write user requirement specifications for medical devices, and that's a bit the systematic approach that I try to take to coaching as well, with a process similar to writing user requirement specifications for a product, but applying that to coaching, of course. Now, how has my philosophy changed since starting Scientific Triathlon? So, yeah, a bit of background. I started coaching full-time in 2017. Scientific Triathlon has actually been around a bit longer than that, but let's use October 2017 as the benchmark, because obviously starting to work full-time in coaching is something that really accelerates your learning in whatever it is that you're doing. I would say that my coaching philosophy has grown to become a lot more informed by areas outside of just the physical training and the physiology since then. So I've learned about how things like psychology, beliefs, enjoyment, and so on can impact training outcomes. And I've learned about how communication and different styles of communication between the coach and the athlete based on their personalities and so on, how that also can impact training outcomes. And that's actually one of the clearest example of, if I could go back to 2017 and do a much better job today than I did in 2017, is working with athletes that had a quite different personality type than I did, and I wasn't very good at communicating with them, and they weren't good at communicating with me. But today I kind of know how to do that, working with with very different types of athletes, with very different personalities from very different cultures and so on. So that's something that has improved massively. And I think that that is something that I have integrated in my coaching philosophy. And that's been probably the biggest changes, I would say, areas outside of physical training and their impact on training outcomes. And that is integrated into the coaching philosophy and methodology as a core part of it. I have, of course, made changes to the training process itself as well. I used to prescribe a bit more intensity in the early days than I do now. Not a massive change, but some change there. I definitely now use more and more RPE as a primary guide to intensity and often the only guide to intensity, more than I used to do. And one more thing, I think, is that I have a lot more experience to see when an athlete is essentially limited by volume, and that is almost the only thing that we can do to go to the next level and be able to tell an athlete that I think that that's the case. I think that in the early days, first of all, I didn't have the experience to see that, but also I maybe wouldn't have had the courage to say so, because then I thought that the athlete might stop working with me and I would not be able to pay my bills. So I think that's a summary of a few things that I think are important that have changed. I'm conscious that maybe not all of them could be classified as coaching philosophy, but almost like just information or things that I think about certain things. But I think it gives you a good idea and it answers the gist of the question, hopefully at least. And if not, I'll just try to do it better another time. I did spend quite some time on this, but I didn't really get satisfied with my answer. But yeah, this is my deadline day to finish the podcast episode, so I just need to be happy with it and record it and move on with my life. I also think that you can probably hear at this point, by the way, speaking of it being deadline day, that I am still recovering from some sickness, and I can hear my voice is not really handling talking for a long time that well, so apologies for that, but hopefully I'll manage until the end of this episode with quite a few breaks and drinking lots of water. But anyway, moving on, Michael has a part two to his question, which is, how have your views of the role of science in coaching changed? And would you still name your business Scientific Triathlon? So basically, I think that science cannot teach you the most important things in coaching, which is how to make the right big picture decisions and planning for and with your athlete. But it can help you with more detailed, zoomed in questions and problems. For me, for example, I use science a lot in certain areas like heat training and specific design of high intensity intervals, but I don't use it for bigger picture things like periodization, deciding on the balance of volume and intensity, etc. That's all driven by coaching experience and my own application of a systematic process, which is based on the scientific method in each individual case, applied, of course, not a peer-reviewed scientific method. But when making those big picture decisions, basically, I think it's important as a coach that you do that while critically evaluating your own process and questioning your own biases, because that's the way that you can improve your coaching the most and the quickest. So I do not think that it's scientific to try to prescribe all training based on things that you find in academic papers and so on, because then if you do that, you don't have a grasp on the limitations of the science and how little we actually know, and also how applicable that is to the individual in front of you. The job of a scientist is to ask questions and make observations and design experiments and use a priori information, of course, to have good hypotheses for what might work and so on. So that's where science comes in. It can be good a priori information, but it's not necessarily going to give you a straight answer for any single athlete. So have my views of the role of science in coaching changed? I don't think they've changed so much as they've evolved to be just for me to see that science is a little bit less actionable over the years. Not less important at all, because you need, I think it's super important to know as much science as you possibly can, because that is very important, as I said, a priori information that is super useful as a coach. But the more you learn about the limitations and where you can and cannot rely on science, the more you understand that there are quite few areas where you actually really can directly apply something from a paper, I think, to a training plan, let's say. So it has become a bit less actionable, and I think it has I think science can more often help you to decide what not to do in training than what to do, because it's easier to get a strong evidence base to show that something does not work than to show that something works. That's how the scientific method is set up. You're trying to disprove hypotheses. You're not trying to prove hypotheses. But the more you cannot disprove hypotheses, then of course the stronger that hypothesis becomes. So practically, I would say that the way that things have changed a bit is that there are fewer scenarios now where I would go directly to science in search for some answers to a particular question. And this is because, as I said, I know more about the limitations of different areas of science, but also with more and more coaching knowledge and experience, which is more valuable and actionable than any knowledge, academic knowledge, then I don't need to look to science as much as directly to my coaching knowledge and experience. Science still, as I said, is super important in forming hypotheses and testing them out, and then using observations from coaching to acquire more coaching experience. But what hasn't changed, as I said, is my views that of the importance of having the mindset of a scientist and not a rogue scientist, because there are a lot of rogue scientists that are well known on social media these days, probably the most well known ones, because they have super strong opinions about something. A scientist, in the true definition of the word, or I don't know, to me at least, a scientist is somebody that observes, formulates hypotheses, experiments, updates their prior knowledge based on new evidence, and is always curious and open-minded. So I think that that's the most important thing about science, and that hasn't changed at all. If anything, I think it's even more important, and I try to be even more like systematic about how I apply a scientist's mindset in my coaching than I used to be. I would also recommend going to Paulo Sousa's Instagram. He wrote, actually, the day after I had written my original script for this podcast, but before recording it, he wrote a post about the science in coaching, and it was super good and so topical. I'm not going to read it out loud. I was thinking about doing it, but I'll just link to the post in the episode description. Paulo Sousa, as you know, has been on the podcast before, and he's one of the greatest coaches in the world, and focuses mostly on short course triathlon, and has one of the most successful squad in the game. So definitely go and check out that post that he wrote really well about this topic. The second part of your question, of part two of your question, I guess, was, would I still name the business scientific triathlon? So to be honest there, that is an interesting question that I have pondered a few times. Scientific triathlon is a name that I thought about for a whole of 10 seconds, more or less, and found that the domain was available. So it wasn't a very thought through name at all. But the name doesn't come from any kind of notion that all training and coaching should be based on academic papers or knowledge from that. It comes from what I said before, from applying the concepts of a scientist's mindset, or from the concepts of the scientific method in a training and coaching context. So it's about being curious, open-minded, and systematic, observing, experimenting, and updating your prior knowledge. So I am going to read a bit from the Wikipedia page about the scientific method for those that are maybe not so familiar. So it says that the scientific method involves careful observation, applying rigorous skepticism about what is observed, given that cognitive assumptions can distort how one interprets the observation. It involves formulating hypotheses via induction based on such observations. The testability of hypotheses, experimental and the measurement-based statistical testing of deductions drawn from the hypothesis, and refinement or elimination of the hypothesis based on the experimental findings. These are principles of the scientific method as distinguished from a definitive series of steps applicable to all scientific enterprises. So obviously not all of those parts can be fully applied in coaching practice. Like, you will never be able to do rigorous statistical testing on an N equals one experiment, and every athlete is an N equals one experiment. But largely those concepts fit in very well with how I view coaching, even though I didn't necessarily use all of those terms, but I'm fully on board with them, with the need to formulate hypotheses, conduct careful observations, apply skepticism, being aware of cognitive biases, refining and or eliminating hypotheses, and so on. So whether I would still name the business scientific triathlon, I really don't know. Probably not. I would probably consult a branding expert if I started again and I had the resources, and they would probably come up with something great. But that said, the name still works very well with the core values and principles of the business, so I'm not looking to change it, and I'm happy enough with it. Now, part number three of Michael's question is, what are you currently exploring or interested in exploring that might lead your coaching methodology to further evolve? So, yeah, this is a great question. I think it's clear from my previous answers that I have a huge interest in psychology and communication. And I think that, these are areas that I'm exploring, and there's a lot more that I want to explore in these areas that could drive further improvements in my coaching. And I would even consider going and getting a degree in one of those areas. I think it's that important. But in the meantime, that's where I do most of my reading and learning at the moment. There are lots of other things that I would consider doing and that I think would help me improve as a coach. And I would say that learning more anatomy and physiotherapy is probably number two on my list. And number three is probably bike fitting. Number four would be to spend a ton of time on pool deck with top swimmers and top swimming coaches. And number five would probably be to coach kids, which I think would be very fun and rewarding and educational. So yeah, that's just a bit of a wish list for things that I might go on to add to my CV potentially in the future. Thank you for your question, Michael. So I had several more questions lined up for this episode, but I think I'm going to cut it there because my voice is not doing so good after talking continuously. So I am going to record another Q&A, not next week. Next week will be an episode with Jem Arnold, which I highly recommend you tune in for. But in the next few weeks, there will be another Q&A for sure with some of the other questions that have been sent in. But I hope you enjoyed this one, even though it was a bit shorter. It was the best I could do. I waited as many days as I could for the sickness to subside, but this is my deadline day, and I'm still not really capable of talking continuously for such a long time. You can, as always, of course, find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. And remember that, as I said at the beginning of the episode, we now have one room available due to cancellation for our Mallorca training camp, and it is for a minimum occupancy of two people. I should mention as well that you can also come with a friend or with your spouse or partner, even if they are not participating in the training. So only one person needs to be participating in the training camp itself, as long as there are two people occupying the room. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelhydration.com. If you're looking for electrolytes and fueling products, I would highly recommend trying them out. You can use their free fuel hydration planner or even a free video consultation with the team to prepare your race strategy. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS23. And thank you to Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke rate, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis. And use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim Goggles. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.